Greetings, faithful listeners. This is your co-host, Dave Kale, with a brief announcement. Recently, we've received some feedback that the sound quality has been somewhat diminished on the last few episodes. In particular, people have said that they can't hear me quite as well, I'm too quiet, things like that. We apologize for that, and believe it or not, we tried to make some adjustments for this episode, which it's not clear they made things better. It's possible they might have even made them worse. I'm looking at our waveforms and some editing software, and I do look a lot quieter. And I'm going to be honest with you, we're not quite sure why this is. Although we are relatively experienced amateur podcasters, we are not professionals or knowledgeable sound engineers, and we don't use a professional setup. We use a pair of USB mics, Skype, and a MacBook Pro laptop, and all the recording and mixing and editing is done in software. We don't have a soundboard or anything like that. So it's actually kind of hard to tell what our levels are while we're recording. So this is something we're going to have to keep working on. We promise we will get it worked out, because although we're not professionals, we are persistent, so we won't give up. But please be patient with us while we figure it out. Thank you, and enjoy the show. Good morning, listeners, and welcome back to another episode of Riddles in the Dark from the Mythgard Institute. I'm your co-host, Dave Kale, and with me this morning, as always, my ever-faithful companion, the Tolkien professor, Corey Olson.
That's good. That makes me sound really charmingly Sam-like. Yes. I consider that a great compliment.
Yeah. Right. That's like
very
the greatest,
good morning.
That's the greatest compliment in Middle-earth, right? The fact that
that's right.
You're a loyal friend.
That's right. Exactly. Loyal, self-effacing. That's right.
And always very be depended upon.
That's right. That's right. Well, good morning, and good morning, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Riddles in the Dark, where we decided today that we would actually get around to talking about, you know, The Hobbit. We haven't really talked. We've talked, of course, off and on about Bilbo. A little hard to ignore the topic. But we haven't really actually sat down and treated Bilbo, with any sort of consistency. So today we're going to start a series where we're going to be going through sort of the major arc of Bilbo's character and thinking about the kinds of challenges that that's going to present, to Peter Jackson and the filmmakers, and to be thinking about how they might handle some of those things. So today's show is going to be specifically on Bilbo at the beginning, you know, basically the kind of chapter one Bilbo that we get, that is, of course, plays such an important role in setting up the story and in setting up the progress of Bilbo's character through the book, and how they're going to be handling that in the context of all the other stuff that's going on and from the, you know, with all of the later perspectives worked in and everything. So,
and we should add that where we're heading with this, I mean, obviously this is going to be a recurring topic over the next 2 years, because the whole story of The Hobbit naturally is about The Hobbit and his arc. But in the next month, where we're heading with this is culminating at kind of that sort of pivotal moment in his character, in his story, the showdown with Gollum in the very aptly named Riddles in the Dark chapter.
That's right. That's right. So we're going to be looking at the setup of Bilbo's character, the sort of the starting point of Bilbo's character arc today. And then next week we're going to be looking at – we're going to sort of – interrupt or supplement or something our discussion of Bilbo to – we're going to stop and talk about Gollum next week, looking at the depiction of Gollum's character and sort of the Gollum storylines and backstory, in order to set up a discussion specifically of the sort of the turning point of Bilbo's character. Of course, the Riddles in the Dark chapter is a crucial one, obviously, in the story, and a really important moment for Bilbo's character. So we're going to be talking specifically about how How the film is going to be treating not only that encounter between the two of them, but really sort of Bilbo's character. So we're basically be going back to looking at the role that that's going to play in Bilbo's character development, and then we'll go on from there to be looking at Bilbo's later development, such as his rescue of the dwarves from the spiders and his behavior in the elf tunnels and everything. So we will, that's where we're going to be headed. So we're going to do Bilbo at the beginning this week, Gollum next week, and then the Riddle Game and Bilbo's development as an adventurer as we move forward from there. So that's the plan. You guys can be ready for that and can be readying your comments and questions and theories and things as we move forward there.
Yep, we're really excited to finally get to the Riddle Games, I think.
Yes.
I'm excited anyway.
Definitely. Yes, and anyway, speaking of readers' theories and or listeners' theories and comments, we have some, I think, from last time.
Yes, we do. We have some good ones. For one, and I don't want to get mired in this, but going down the comments on the Mythgard website from previous episode, which all of these have been like in the last 4 days since I only released it earlier this week, sadly. or I guess it was late last week. Candrel Strongbeard says they disagree emphatically with your pronouncements on pronunciation of dwarven names.
Okay.
I think they misunderstood you. They say let's see. It is not, I don't know how they intend this to be pronounced, Dane, but dying. I'm pretty sure that's what we actually said. The emphasis on the first vowel. I'm fairly certain that's what you were saying, right?
Yes. The emphasis on the first vowel. That it's the reason that Tolkien puts the accent mark over the first vowel is to indicate that it's not, that you're not supposed, it's not a diphthong. You're not combining the A and the I. AI as a combined vowel sound in Tolkien's names is generally pronounced I, like the Ainur, for instance, in the Silmarillion. But when he puts an accent on the first vowel, and he puts an accent over the A, that is generally to indicate, just as when he puts, you know, as I said last time, the circumflex, or the, not the circumflex, the umlaut, over the terminal E, that means you're supposed to pronounce it. So yes, the stress is on the first syllable. Yes. So it'd be Dayan, yes.
But the other part that he says is he thinks that the A sound should be not A as in day, but ah as in bark. What do you think?
I don't think so.
I'm not sure there's evidence for that.
Well, basically, the primary difference between those is you're talking about the difference between a long vowel and a short vowel,
yes,
primarily. And I mean, now that's not necessarily true. You do a long ah, that is, you know, really the question is like a Latinate ah. And I don't know. I mean, I don't, mostly I think that that's just very hard to say. Dine. I mean, I just, yeah, I don't really see it. And again, here I would bring the Tolkien family anecdote evidence into play also. That is that, that speech that I was alluding to last time, where they did use words like stay in, as their like mock dwarf names, which leads me to believe that they were pronounced things like dayin and thrayin rather than dyin and thryin. And as I said, like, I don't even know what to do with dyin.
I feel like dyin in sort of normal usage, except when you're conscientiously trying to really differentiate the those syllables, that dying inevitably ends up sounding a lot like dying.
Right, exactly. I mean, that's basically where that sound comes from, is you combine those two vowel sounds and you get – that's why it makes sense. You know, sometimes – I know that sometimes – Especially American speakers look at the AI sound like an Einor and think that it's really counterintuitive that you should say I when you see that. But exactly as you say, that's in fact the sound of the Latinate ah and then the I sound.
Right.
You make those sounds together and you've got I.
It sort of stays back in your throat as opposed to coming out into the front of your mouth.
Exactly. So basically if they really are designed to be multisyllabic names, then you can't do the diphthong. Because if you do the ah vowel, it does inescapably become a diphthong. You can't really do it. That would be my counter argument there. But I do have to say I don't think that that's, I don't think it's that big a deal, you know. Like, if you want to say dine, that's at least it's at least consistent with the other vowel usage. You know, it's better than just Dane, basically, is what I'm saying. Yep. Dane, I think, is kind of legitimately wrong. Dine is okay. Dane, I think, is probably closer, but you know, I'm not going to get up in arms about it.
Yep, and there'll probably never be a definitive answer about this.
Yeah.
That, which in my opinion is one of my favorite parts about this world.
Yes, I understand.
There were a ton of comments. I mentioned this to you earlier this week. There are a ton of comments and interest about what Sauron's going to look like on screen.
What
form's going to be. I think we're going to leave those because We've committed ourselves to, we will eventually, when we get around to it, do an episode on Sauron and the Necromancer. And so we want to stop anticipating ourselves on that.
Yeah, we thought about doing that this week, of course, but basically I've been feeling like we've put off talking about Bilbo and Gollum long enough. It is time now, and we can come back and talk about the Necromancer more. And we have been discussing it some.
Yes.
So I don't feel like we've been totally neglecting it. I agree that there's more that we can say, and we will come back and say some more later on. But for now, by golly, let's get on to talking about Bilbo.
Yes, I agree. One thing that I think would be good to discuss is which is a comment from Adam. He points out Bilbo's the whole story thing from the trailer, where Bilbo says, "You know, I told you that everything I told you was true, but I didn't tell you the whole story."
Mm-hmm.
He was wondering if this is a mere reference to Bilbo's white lie, i.e., he's referring directly to the encounter with Gollum in the story for how he acquired the ring, similar to the Council of Elrond and his the way he sort of teed things up
right.
for his story there, or whether maybe couldn't be taken as a reference to the larger story, to all the sort of basically apocryphal material.
Right.
So when he says, "I didn't tell you the whole story," he's saying, "Oh, I didn't tell you about the Necromancer, and I didn't tell you about the White Council, and all the stuff that Gandalf was up to," which I think is a very interesting notion. My sort of curiosity there is if it couldn't also, in that sense, be taken as a meta comment from the producers. It's basically sort of not a warning, but they're capturing the attention of the viewer, of people watching the trailer, anticipating the movie, to say, this is not exactly what you're going to be expecting if you're expecting a very faithful direct translation of the book onto film.
Right. Yes. I mean, that's how I take it too. I mean, certainly in the context of Bilbo's story from the Lord of the Rings perspective, you know, that is like, you know, the direct reference is in the book to Bilbo not having told the whole story. Those clearly are as in the Council of Elrond, as you mentioned, those clearly are references to the fact that he had lied about the riddle game, or rather lied about the ring, the end of the riddle game, and the giving of the ring as a present and all that stuff. But in the film, it does seem that it's setting us up for the other. And I would just say, like, that actually that seems to me to work really well. That is, it actually, what it nods to is something which is really from a textual standpoint. That is from, and I mean that not just like referring to the book as literature, but like as a text, as a written document, and the way that Tolkien places so much emphasis on the actual textual history of the stories within the framework of Middle-earth. You know, how the story of the Hobbit began as Bilbo's private diary, and then was retold and incorporated into the Red Book of Westmarch, which was then recopied and everything else, and with supplemented by the learning of the wise and all this stuff. Given the textual history of it, it actually is quite, that idea really does work, and it has a lot of traction, I think, within Tolkien's, works within Tolkien's idea. There's my apologies.
You sound as though your attention is being torn away.
It is. Sorry, I'm broadcasting from home today.
Yep, that's a danger.
Yes, it is. Okay, sorry. My apologies.
No worries. It's all right.
Yes. Normally, I am broadcasting from home instead of from my office at school.
Worst case scenario, we just edited it out and it never happened.
Exactly. Which door I can lock. But anyway, sorry. So, as I was saying, The way that the films seem to be setting that up, the way that they seem to be inviting us to look at that, is I do take it in just the way that you were saying. Now you're going to get the full version of the story. Now you're going to get the full backstory. And it would make sense that Frodo might have heard Bilbo's own private diary version, which not only will be much more selective, that is, in the years since he has learned more, presumably from Gandalf, mm-hmm. about not only the stuff that happened that he didn't see and wasn't directly a part of, but also even sort of the greater significance of the story that he was personally involved in. And in addition, like the stuff that he either didn't understand or didn't see about his own part of the story. Like what was really going on with Thorin, all the Quest for Erebor stuff, you know, about what the dwarves really thought of him and, you know, that basically his own diary, his own little hobbit story is essentially a very selective version of what happened, and that he's going to get that he's going to tell the rounded out version, which is probably going to depict him and his role rather differently, or at least give us insight into what other people thought that was not there in the original diary. Again, all that stuff seems to me very plausible, seems to me in fact implicit in the textual situation that Tolkien describes. One could imagine a young Frodo who had grown up with the diary version, essentially, of the Hobbit story, now being introduced to the full significance of that tale. So, you know, so that I think that seems to me a very logical kind of setup, and I would assume that it referred to all of those things. That is, to the events that he hadn't seen, to the significance of all of the, you know, sort of the larger context of the things that he did take part in, mm-hmm. and even to the more, I guess one might say, sort of realistic or accurate depiction of the his character and of the interactions, which implies, I would say, one thing. I mean, if that is in fact the way that we're taking it, one thing that this might mean. If we're to understand Bilbo's words in that way, it relates then back to the question we talked about last week, which was about the reliability of the narrator question.
Yes.
Because basically it suggests the narrator of the film is indeed going to be reliable, because this is going to be Bilbo opening up and being honest about everything. And therefore, you know, so that
well,
basically setting us
as
up
honest
to trust
as he
what
can
he's
be.
Saying. Right, exactly. Which, I mean, it doesn't eliminate completely the point of view question or the scope of knowledge question.
Right.
But it does at least prompt us anyway to see, it does at least prompt us to see, him as being reliable. Anyway, that like now he's telling the real story and sort of expanding his own role. He's not being either clueless or flattering of himself.
Yeah, we're not going to get the sort of almost I can't remember if they did this in Princess Bride, but basically the sort of him recounting a story and Gandalf sitting there saying no, that's not how it happened at all, and then rewatching the scene in the Gandalf corrected version or
right.
Yeah, I suspect that will be the case. I doubt they would go that route with this. I think they might play a little bit with the whole narrative stuff, but I think that's something that for the vast majority of people who will be sitting in the theaters for these films this fall, that the effect of that would be lost on them.
Right.
I think the only people that would be sitting around really excited to see, I wonder how they'll play with the narrative point of view and the reliability of the narrator. The only people who are going to be really excited about that are basically the people listening to this podcast.
Right, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, no,
is an enormous group of people, but it probably, regardless, pales in comparison to the watching public for the film.
Yes. No, I agree with that. I agree with that. But I mean, it does, you know, the one question that I think that issue raises, but still doesn't completely answer, is the question of Gandalf's participation or Gandalf's perspective. I mean, at the very least, Bilbo is going to have to be recognizing, or rather, we're going to have to be sort of implicitly made aware that If the film is to be a story essentially that Bilbo is telling Frodo, he's got to have gotten most of that information about the other stuff from Gandalf. So is there going to be any level of direct contribution of Gandalf? Are we going to get, you know, as we talked about last time, Gandalf and Bilbo and Frodo sitting around as part of the frame? Or is Bilbo just going to be recognizing that this kind of came from Gandalf? Because that does then still potentially limit the scope. Or it's also quite possible, again, you know, as you say, that they're just going to kind of simplify this a little bit, and they're not going to think about it or ask us to think about it quite as much.
Right. Well, I do think that the reliability of the narrator thing aside, although the chat room, the popular theory in the chat room is that the best opportunity for that is going to be the talking purse.
Oh yes.
You know, people seem very reluctant to let that die. They insist it's going to be in there.
But, you know, let me tell you, I will be so happy if one of the trolls' purses talks. Here's my question. How does that happen on screen? I mean, like, seriously. Like, how do you, like, does it have a mouth? Does the mouth of the purse talk? Like the opening the mouth of the purse, does it, like, make lips and talk? Does a voice just emerge out of the purse? Like, how do you do that? I don't even know. So I'll be kind of surprised. And you have to have it on screen, because if you don't show that it's the purse talking and there's just a voice, no one who doesn't know the book very well is going to even suspect that it's the purse talking.
Maybe it'll be Easter egg, like just sort of dropped in there, and nobody. The only people who'll notice it will be people who actually listen to this podcast. Yeah. So here's a theory from Facebook, posted overnight from Caleb. He says, if they go for a framing device with Frodo and Bilbo, they could play with the idea that Bilbo's an unreliable narrator, yada, yada, yada. So you could have a talking purse cut to Frodo, who says, you're kidding, right? Bilbo admits, yeah, I made that bit up, sorry. All right, I stepped on a twig, okay?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, of course, you know, the thing is that the talking purse – Which, though, like, there's no getting around the fact that the talking purse is strange, and is always something that modern readers find very weird. I don't think that Tolkien would have, I mean, to actually make the talking purse an instance of unreliability would be a huge deviation. I mean, like, you know, the fact is, in Tolkien's world, sometimes inanimate stuff talks. You know, Turin's sword talks to him too. And this is part of the tradition that he was following. I mean, you know, like, stuff talks. You know, like, read the Kalevala. You know, you'll get, well, you'll find talking gear in the Kalevala. It happens. So it just, it actually, in The Hobbit, it doesn't feel very organic because we don't get any, because it's so kind of incidental and unexpected, and we don't get that kind of thing anywhere else. Mm-hmm. But basically, I think that's, it's kind of a nod to this older tradition. Just as, you know, elsewhere in that same passage, he sort of throws out, like, you know, for trolls, as you probably know, turn into stone when they're exposed to sunlight, which of course was actually not a very dominant idea that everybody was familiar with. But it's a way that the narrator, you know, that Tolkien's narrator has of essentially connecting the story that's happening with old tradition, even if that old tradition does not always fully exist and certainly is not necessarily in the you know, the primary consciousness of the readers of the story. And the same thing happens with the purse. You know, the line that introduces that is, you know, trolls' purses are the mischief, right? Like, everybody knows this. You know, like, so of course, if you're going to pick the purse of a troll, like, most likely, like, it's going to cause you trouble, not just because the troll is likely to eat you, but apparently there's something magical about trolls' purses and they can talk. So you're not going to get away with it. Yeah. So I, you know, within the story, it's not really as kind of alien and trippy as it seems like to a lot of modern readers. But I think the troll's purse is about as likely to talk in the film as the elves are to swing from the trees and sing tra-la-la-lally, but we'll see.
which is to say, extremely likely.
Extremely. Oh, yes. Extremely likely.
All right. One last listener question, because I think this is a really good one to address. Setting aside the reliability thing and getting into scope of knowledge, there's going to be a ton of stuff that is going to be included in this film that we, if we're to presume that this really is Bilbo narrating this and they're not just being sloppy, that apparently Gandalf tells Bilbo and tells him in great detail, since he's going to know all these internal details about him entering Dol Guldur, entering Nazgul tombs, all kinds of things like that.
Yes.
Mike points out this introduces the possibility of potential inconsistencies, since Frodo, and I haven't verified this, I didn't watch it last night, but he points out, I think he's right, Frodo in the film, when they're discussing, or maybe this is even the book too, I really should go check this, Frodo in the film thinks Sauron was destroyed on the slopes of Mount Doom.
Mm-hmm. Yep, no, that's definitely in the film. I mean, I can remember...
So
I can remember Elijah Wood saying that, you know, but he was destroyed. Sauron was destroyed.
Yes, exactly. Yep. You're right. So obviously, Bilbo sitting and recounting the whole entire story as he knows it about how Sauron was in Mirkwood, would seem to contradict Frodo's later ignorance about the fact that Sauron was not destroyed on the slopes of Mount Doom. Either that or Frodo is a real idiot. That was the alternative theory I proposed in my response to the guy's comment. Maybe Frodo's just a complete moron.
Which I suppose can't be ruled out.
Yeah, that's right. He seems even, he does seem like he's a bit of a doofus in the films, more so even than in the books.
Oh, way more, way more. Yeah, I mean, that's the main thing that they play up, and the main consequence, as we talked about a couple months ago, about not introducing the 17, or rather removing the 17-year gap between the unexpected party and the rest of it.
Not this big of an idiot.
Yeah, that would be a little bit surprising. No, I agree. I mean, that does create a potential.
My sort of take on it is I rather suspect they're not ever going to tell us on screen that he's Sauron.
I was going to suggest the same thing. Yeah, really? I do think that could very well be downplayed in the films. That is, he's going to be the necromancer, and that's how he'll be alluded to.
My theory was that they would handle this by sort of narrowly walking between not declaring him explicitly as Sauron on screen and or by being sloppy with the frame narrative. So in the sense of showing us events on screen that Bilbo doesn't actually know.
Right.
So Bilbo says, hey, there was a White Council thing about the necromancer guy or whatever. And then we see the whole scene unfold, including details that Bilbo has no way of knowing.
Right. Right. And really, that would be an argument for the frame really receding into the background. That is, having the viewers thinking about the Frodo-Bilbo frame as little and as infrequently as possible. Such that, for instance, perhaps – you know, perhaps it doesn't even return to it at the end. One could imagine it just being used as an introductory gambit, and then we never even go back to it.
Yep.
They could leave it that far behind.
And then, actually, you know, this is an interesting idea. I initially rejected it, but actually it's an interesting idea. Zax Hammer in the chat room does point out that it's possible maybe the way they'll tell the events at Dol Guldur that – maybe Frodo will think that he was destroyed in Dol Guldur.
Hmm.
I mean, I think it'd be impossible for the White Council not to know that he's still alive and has escaped.
Yeah.
But maybe they lied to everyone.
Yeah, or just, I mean, you know, the fact that, like, the White Council figures it out and nobody else knows. I mean, that in fact is what happens in Tolkien's version. I mean, when Gandalf goes to Dol Guldur on the occasion when he meets Thran and gets the map and the key, he's there in order to confirm that it's Sauron. And, you know, Tolkien depicts in the essay on the Rings of Power in the Third Age at the end of the Silmarillion, depicts Gandalf coming back to Elrond and being like, yep, it's Sauron, all right. So they know. I mean, so they've known when the Hobbit starts, they've known for a while. And so the White Council knows for decades prior to the War of the Ring that the Necromancer was Sauron. That's why they move against him.
But they didn't share that knowledge widely.
No, they didn't. But though remember, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're hiding anything. The thing that people, I'm beginning to think to like, I want to make this an oft-repeated rule. They don't have the internet in Middle-earth. Don't forget that they don't have the internet in Middle-earth. They don't – seriously, people often seem to forget – like, you know, even basic things. Like, you know, I've heard people say, like, how could they possibly not figure out that the ring that Bilbo found was the one ring? Like, what else could it have been?
How did this not go viral?
Exactly. Well, like, you know, that, like, comparing information, not actually that easy. You know, the wise do seem to be able to communicate. I mean, Elrond and Galadriel and Gandalf can communicate, but most other people don't. And certainly, so, like, people in the Shire, have they heard about this? No. Does Gandalf go around telling everybody he meets? No. Well, of course he doesn't. I mean, why on earth would he? That's not really a great idea. I mean, what, is he just going to, like, you know, have a few beers at the Prancing Pony and be like, so, do you guys know that the Necromancer is actually Sauron? That's awesome, isn't it? I mean, like, why would he do that? He's not going to do that. He's not just going to go around spreading fear and terror in the population for absolutely no purpose. So no, of course the word hasn't gotten out. And even if they were, and even if they're trying to spread it, like it's not going to spread fast and it's not going to spread well. So, that I think is not really an obstacle at all. Could Frodo think that it was at Dol Guldur that the necromancer, that Sauron was destroyed? Well, I mean, certainly in the context of the, you know, the film scene that we were describing, that's obviously not how Gandalf takes his words. I mean, that's in the context of explaining that the ring wasn't destroyed at the time of its taking at Mount Doom. So, that clearly wouldn't work. I mean, unless we're going to argue that Gandalf was just mistaking what Frodo meant, but it seems pretty clear in the context of the film that that's not what he meant. So, this is going to be
very interesting to see how they decide to handle this, because the temptation will be to hit to, you know, the temptation for the, I think the past film fans is going to be to play up the fact that the necromancer is Sauron and very heavily imply it, you know, cause that's the kind of stuff that people who are coming to watch a prequel for the other films are going to want to see. They're going to want to see Sauron. But you know, I think we've discussed this before, that there's two dangers there. One is this idea that it will introduce inconsistencies with the other film, which I think at the end of the day, that's not going to be a real barrier to them doing this. They'll just say, who cares? But the other danger, which we've discussed before, is the fact that if they use him too much, he will overshadow the real villain of the film, which is Smaug, and then the events of the goblin armies and stuff. And that would be a real shame, because that would really alter the story. So I think this is going to be interesting to see how they handle this, particularly in the context of, this is Bilbo relating a story, and I rather suspect that he doesn't actually know the identity of the necromancer.
Yeah, it's at least possible. One thing I want to confirm, because I haven't said this explicitly, the line, you know, the, like, but he was destroyed, Sauron was destroyed, that's just a film thing, it's not in the books. Frodo does not think that Sauron was destroyed in the books. In fact, the line that Gandalf delivers when they start talking about Sauron himself explicitly is, the rumors that you have heard are true. He has indeed risen again and left his hold in Mirkwood and returned to his ancient fastness in the Dark Tower of Mordor. That name even you hobbits have heard of. So, I mean, yeah, there's no question.
Briefly, a question about that by the way, just an aside in the chat room, somebody pointed out that while they don't have Twitter or Facebook in Middle Earth, they do have PalantirNet.
No. Look, I mean, I guess you can call it a network, and maybe back in the day it was a network, but like, what? They've got like a dedicated connection between Orthanc and Barad-dûr at this point. And then what? Come on now.
That's right. It's like rural, it's the equivalent of living in the rural US where all you can get is satellite internet.
except all you can get is like a direct line to hell.
I think there's people in rural US who would claim that their satellite internet's quite similar.
possible. But yeah, no, so it's theoretically, but
here's just briefly, and we really should get onto our topic, but I guess that hearing rumors of Sauron doesn't necessarily conflict with sort of wanting to insist that he was – that, you know, that the rumors aren't true and that he's actually dead. So in some sense, although the film really is kind of changing that and simplifying and glossing it over, do you think that the rumors that they're hearing in the Shire – do you think they're talking about the necromancer? And, oh, yeah, it turns out that was actually Sauron. You know, are they sitting around at the Green Dragon with Ted Sandyman talking about how the necromancer was actually Sauron and, yeah, now he's gone? Or is Gandalf adding in details when he mentions Mirkwood here?
Well, I mean, I do think that Gandalf is adding in, or at least what Gandalf is doing is confirming the truth.
Yes.
Behind the rumors. But it is interesting that, like, Gandalf does not throw that out as if it were a huge revelation. You know, I mean, he's not like, and guess what? The necromancer was actually Sauron all along. And he says he has left his fastness in southern Mirkwood. You know, like, yeah, you've probably heard that the necromancer was actually Sauron. And I mean, like, there had been rumors and speculations. Basically, the big question was, who is this necromancer dude? And it turns out the answer was Sauron.
And Frodo's probably hearing these rumors from, you know, we were told in the books that he actually, like Bilbo, he wanders throughout the Shire,
yep.
wanders to the border, speaks extensively with travelers, trying to get any and all news they can get. So this probably isn't the usual gossip at the Green Dragon with the other hobbits. This is, he's talking to dwarves and men.
Yep.
Or other travelers.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and here I'll read sort of the fuller passage. This is in The Shadow of the Past, chapter 2 of The Fellowship of the Ring, and it's before he starts his conversation with Gandalf. So this is basically what Frodo has heard prior to his long conversation with Gandalf. But now Frodo often met strange dwarves of far countries seeking refuge in the west. They were troubled, and some spoke in whispers of the enemy and of the land of Mordor. That name the hobbits only knew in legends of the dark past, like a shadow in the background of their memories, but it was ominous and disquieting. It seemed that the evil power in Mirkwood had been driven out by the White Council, only to reappear in greater strength in the old strongholds of Mordor. The Dark Tower had been rebuilt, it was said. From there the power was spreading far and wide, and far away east and south there were wars and growing fear. Oh, and this is what leads up to the sentence that I quoted a while back when we were talking about the trolls. Orcs were multiplying again in the mountains. Trolls were abroad, no longer dull-witted, but cunning and armed with dreadful weapons. So if you meet trolls, don't expect Bert and Tom and Bill Huggins. and there were murmured hints of creatures more terrible than all of these, but they had no name, setting us up for the Black Riders, of course. So these are the, you know, the fact that there is a connection between the necromancer and Sauron is there. But you'll notice the way that it's phrased is because even like who Sauron is exactly is something which is a matter of ancient legend. I mean, remember, gosh, the destruction of the destruction of Barad-dûr, the taking of the ring by Isildur bears the chronological relation to Frodo sitting in Bag End, that what, like ancient Egypt bears to us?
Yes.
So, you know, we're not talking about like, you know, have you been keeping up with the news lately? We're talking about ancient. So like who is Sauron? Like that name, like what that, you know, there's this idea of a dark lord. And so, I mean, I think it's the way that Tolkien describes that, you can see that this is kind of as far as the hobbits themselves or even the dwarves themselves, who are the ones who are traveling and tell him this, understand. The evil power in Mirkwood had been driven out only to reappear in greater strength in the old strongholds of Mordor. So there's this evil power. We know there's this evil power. We don't really know much about him. We don't know who the guy is. We don't know his personal history. Saying Sauron doesn't even mean all that much. We just know there's this dark lord. There's this evil guy who's got orcs and everything. And he was in southern Mirkwood, and now that power has moved to Mordor, which is, like, we know from ancient stories, we know is the you know, was the stronghold of the Dark Lord back in ancient times. Is like, you know, is it the same dude risen again? Like, they're not even really thinking in those terms. Like, oh, so Sauron's still been around. I wonder what he's been doing kicking around for the last couple thousand years. They're not asking that question. They're just like, and now, oh, great, there's an evil power in Mordor again. Like, that's just like old stories. That can't be good.
They're basically just assigning names to things, but the significance that it holds for it is certainly not the same as the significance it holds for us.
Yeah, they don't have the Silmarillion. You know, like they don't have like a one volume treatment of the history of the whole story so that you can follow this big picture version of, you know, of the history and the mythology. All they have are these ancient stories, many of which are probably, you know, like garbled and inaccurate. And they're hearing rumors that are connected with some of those old stories, but still in ways that they don't fully understand. So when Gandalf comes in, he's confirming, yes, like the stories are true. Yes, he gives a little bit more background. And this is, of course, it's in this context that he then goes on to tell Frodo some of the, you know, that's what we get in the rest of chapter two in the conversation between Gandalf and Frodo, is that bigger picture view. Let me tell you the story about the Rings of Power. He doesn't tell the whole story, right? He doesn't go back to the First Age and Sauron's history back there. But what he does do is basically start from Eregion onward, start with the Rings of, with the forging of the Rings of Power. He skips over Numenor, right? I mean, he doesn't do all of Sauron's story. This is not a complete biography. This is not Sauron, This Is Your Life. But instead, it's just, you know, here's all that you need to know about the ring, and how this is related and who this, you know, and the real significance. It's not just that another evil power is growing in Mordor. It's the same guy. And this is really important because you're wearing his ring, you know? So like that's the story that Frodo, of course, is going to get. But now back to the Hobbit film then. How is this treated in the Hobbit film? And the more I think about it, I think that those two factors, if we have those two conflicting factors, on the one hand, the desire to maintain consistency with the frame narrative and with the ignorance that Frodo is in at the beginning of the Fellowship of the Ring film. And on the other hand, the desire to create what people are inevitably thinking of as a prequel. You know, and it's being explicitly called that. I mean, if you're going to have a prequel and Sauron is in the prequel, as you say, people are going to want to know that. People are going to want to see that. I mean, people are going to want to see a flaming eyeball sooner or later in these films. You know, I think like my suspicion is that people will be just as insistent on seeing a flaming eyeball by the end of movie two as they were to see, you know, the Darth Vader mask by the end of the third Star Wars prequel.
Yep.
Right? I mean, like, we've got to get Anakin inside that black helmet by the end of the last film. Like, however, that must happen.
However poorly it's executed or right. awkward it seemed.
No comment. No comment. Yes. Yes. And however, never mind. I'm not even going to go there. But you see what I mean, right? Like, I mean, like the part of the story, part of the, and of course, and with the Star Wars one, of course, like the central story of those first three movies is like how Darth Vader becomes Darth Vader. Obviously, the focus of the Hobbit films is not the same. It's not like how Sauron becomes Sauron. But still, if we're going to have – it gives them the opportunity, which I cannot imagine they're not going to take, of giving Sauron a character arc. You know, we're going to get Sauron is not just a flaming eyeball on a stick. Instead, you know, he develops there. He gets there over time.
Yes.
And I, you know, again, I can't imagine them resisting that. And I mean, not that we're going to get the full or even a superior, you know, Anakin Skywalker treatment. I mean, I'm not suggesting they're going to show us like Sauron falling to the dark side or something, but to show development from, you know, the comparatively small time or at least in hiding necromancer and the whole, I mean, it's one of the things which is also potentially implied by the whole like setting free of the Nazgul thing.
Yep.
Right. So, you know, like the building of his empire and they're like, now all the pieces are in place. I shall go and become a flaming eyeball. Like that's, you can see that happening. Especially if they just, but anyway, so here we are like spontaneously doing a Sauron episode after all. So
I can't stay away from it. People including us are obsessed.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
All right. All right. Bilbo.
Bilbo. Yes. After like an hour of show, we're getting to our topic for crying out loud.
And so,
okay.
And the topic of this week is Bilbo.
The topic of this week is Bilbo. Okay, so.
You'd be surprised to hear this.
Yes, yes, exactly. All right, so Bilbo. The main thing, of course, you know, thinking from the book perspective, the primary focus, you know, the thing that I am most interested in chapter one of The Hobbit, is the way that Bilbo's initial character is sketched. You know, he starts as the Hobbit. I mean, you know, like that's, I mean, in the book, that is literally how he functions. That's the title of the book. He is the Hobbit. He's the only Hobbit that we meet. We know that there are other Hobbits, but we don't actually get to know them. We meet a couple more of them at the very end of the book, but at the beginning of the book, we only meet Bilbo. And we're told, what's more, that he is a Baggins, and that the Baggins side of his character, which is dominant, completely dominant in him when we meet him, that, you know, the Baggins side of him is like the prototypical Hobbit culture and character, that his antipathy to adventures, his love of comfort and ease, his predictability. This is one of the things the narrator emphasizes about him. One of the things that hobbits in general approve of in Bagginses is that you can always tell what they're going to say on any subject without even the bother of asking them. They are very predictable. There's nothing surprising. Hobbits apparently don't like to be disturbed. They like their quiet life. And so that's Bilbo as we meet him at the beginning. That is the Baggins side. Now, of course, the sort of the drama that we are given, which is, of course, you know, the sort of preview of what's going to be happening through the rest of the story, is that Bilbo is of mixed Hobbit heritage, that there is this one deviant subculture among the Hobbits, namely the Took clan, who do sometimes have adventures, and they're weird. Now, of course, you know, Tolkien does an interesting thing here. They're not just outcasts, of course. The Tooks, in fact, are the most powerful family in the Shire. They're undoubtedly richer than the Bagginses. And they are powerful and influential. So they're not quite trusted. They are seen as different, but it's not like they're ostracized. It's not like they're outcasts from Hobbit society. They're just not, you know, the mainstream of Hobbit society, which is what, you know, so in a sense, the Tooks are almost above the rest of Hobbit society rather
Nobody's
than being
them
sort of
parties.
Considered below it. They're certainly considered outside it, and they're not particularly, you know, they're not trusty in the same way that Bagginses are trusty.
Nobody's inviting them to parties, or at least if they do, they don't expect them to come.
Right, or at least they expect it to become a different kind of party.
Yeah, right.
Yes, exactly. And but now Bilbo is the child of two people whose names, by the way, I've always thought their names are just brilliant. The names of Bilbo's parents tell you all that you need to know about them without hearing anything else, right? His father's name was Bungo and his mother's name is Belladonna. And we just have that, you know, you have, you know, Bungo Baggins as this, like, the sort of semi-accidental, you know, homophonic implications of bungling. And, you know, he is Bungo Baggins is the epitome of Bagginsishness. You know, he is the epitome of this kind of staid, predictable respectability, right. And is often referred to over the course of the rest of the book. Belladonna gets referred to never again after the first chapter, but Bungo does come back quite a bit, very significantly or very illustratively at the beginning of chapter two, when Bilbo is wearing the dwarfhood because he doesn't have his hat or anything, and so he borrows the ill-fitting dwarfhood from Dwalin, and he's riding along feeling like he looks very ridiculous, and the narrator says what his father Bungo would have thought if he looked at, you know, if he had seen him. I don't like to think, you know, that's the way that Bungo comes up over the course of the rest of the book. Though my favorite Bungo reference is later on when Bilbo is quoting a proverb, like a maxim, about dragons. Every worm has its weak spot, as my father used to say. And then he says, though it wasn't from personal experience, I'm sure. and that by itself actually is that's kind of a whole separate topic, but because it's really interesting. The fact that Bungo Baggins actually does have, you know, like, you know, adages that he quotes about dragons. Like he has, you know, obviously, presumably, Bungo Baggins, you know, does not have personal experience with dragons and has never applied these, you know, and has no intention of applying these, you know, these proverbs to actual dragon slaying situations, right? You know, that clearly, he uses that proverb in the same way that he uses one of the other proverbs that Bilbo quotes of his, you know, third time pays for all. So, so that's
just like throwing them around.
Exactly. These are traditional, seem to be traditional Hobbit proverbs. So again, we have Bilbo's father, connected with like traditional Hobbit wisdom and culture and thought, right? That he is, though again, what I find most fascinating about that is that it is a moment where we can see that there is in fact an infusion of these old adventurous stories in Hobbit culture. Like they still have that proverb about dragons and dragon scales. You know, every worm has his weak spot. The fact that Hobbits say that is very interesting. So
it just out of curiosity as an aside, what do you think that comes from?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it would have to come, I mean, within the frame of the story, it would have to come from, you know, legends of dragon slayings. And we know that there are more than one. I mean, we're only, prior to The Hobbit, we only see one, there's only one dragon slaying depicted, in Tolkien's works, namely the killing of Glaurung by Turin Turambar in the Silmarillion. That story, of course, did exist before The Hobbit, so it is quite possible that Tolkien is kind of thinking of that. In fact, I think, and when we eventually get to Smaug, which we'll probably get to in like, you know, 14 months or something, because we're saving Smaug for next year in anticipation of the second film, I do think that there is a direct though you know, it's not by name, but I do think that there is a reference to Turin Turambar in Smaug's dream. That's how I take Smaug's dream that he has later on. But anyway, we're not talking about Smaug right now. Anyway, so that's the only story in Tolkien's world that we have about dragon slaying, but we know that there are others. There's a reference to another dragon slaying in the appendix of The Lord of the Rings, of course, with the slaying of Skatha the Worm, from whose hoard Merry's horn was taken. You know, so that was, we know that these things have happened. And from stories that we get about, the fact that there are other dragons and that there have been in the past, you know, lots of stories of, you know, fights between dwarves and dragons over treasure in the past. And we know that several of the dwarven rings of power were consumed by dragons. So, we know that there's like this, there does exist this history, which must, there must be stories, you know, it must be part of the folklore that gets handed down, to these later ages. About these stories. And in fact, when the dwarves are in, you know, after Bilbo goes down to Smaug the first time, and the dwarves are sitting around talking about Smaug, they are trotting out all of the stories that they can remember about dragon slayings. Though the narrator recognizes that some of the stories they're trotting out are dubious or mythical. But anyway, they do have stories. So that seems to be where that proverb comes from in Hobbit culture, that there is this traditional idea of dragons and killing dragons, and that even Bilbo's comment to Smaug, you know, I had always understood that, you know, dragons were softer underneath. Well, where did he get that idea? You know, he got that idea from these old stories about dragons. And of course, the one dragon slaying that we do get does bear that out, you know, that Glaurung is stabbed from underneath by Turin. So that does, in fact, seem to be true. Glaurung is stabbed twice underneath, actually, once non-fatally and once fatally. That's kind of interesting. That's this glimpse that we get. The dragon proverb from Bungo is an interesting glimpse of the fact that even Hobbit society, which is very, you know, very, very respectable and very, very, very upright and very non-adventurous and very non-imaginative, is actually built upon a foundation which is different. You know, that they have long since even ceased to think. You know, Bungo probably doesn't even think that he's talking about dragons, you know, when he uses that proverb, because he's applying that proverb in other ways. So he doesn't even probably even think about it.
Right. Yep. It's basically kind of a dead metaphor almost.
Right. Exactly. I would imagine that it is. So then you have the Took. So this, again, I think sort of further complicates the relationship between the Tooks and the rest of the Hobbit society. That is, the Tooks are not like just the weird ones. They're not just the Hobbits who have gone in a different direction from the rest of the Hobbits, or, you know, you start from the foundation of, you know, boring, predictable Hobbit culture, and the Tooks have branched out from that to the wild, wide world of adventure. Instead, it almost suggests the opposite, that it's the Took world which is the foundation, and the rest of the Hobbits have forgotten it, and only the Tooks have remembered and stayed in this old tradition, that perhaps, if you go back a ways, the Hobbits were different, or that Hobbit culture was different. That, anyway, I think is the kind of question that we're invited to ask. And of course, in talking about this stuff, I'm kind of jumping ahead to those later references to Bungo later on in the book. But I think it's important to sort of look at the relationship between kind of the Took culture and the Baggins culture. But of course, the most fascinating thing about, the Hobbit, in one sense, one of the most fascinating things is simply the marriage between Bungo and Belladonna. I mean, how did that happen?
Yeah, it seems complete. It's hard to imagine Bungo's family being real enthusiastic about that match.
Yeah, I mean, there's the one implication that he was a bit of a gold digger, basically. I mean, like, not to put too fine a point on it. I mean, the narrator does say that, you know, he built Bag End for his wife when they were married.
Using her money.
Yes, largely with her money. Exactly. So that reference to the fact that Belladonna's dowry essentially funded the luxurious Bag End does imply that Bungo was clearly much poorer than Belladonna was. So this is not a question of, like, the high and mighty Took family, you know, falling into reduced circumstances and marrying up into a, you know, this is not like a Victorian novel where, like, you know, one of the great duchies of England is fallen on hard times and has to, you know, like, the daughter has to marry into the family of like an up and rising rich banker or something who's very gauche and middle class but incredibly wealthy.
On that note, do you think Belladonna's fortune was entailed?
Yeah. Well, like, away from Bilbo? No, clearly not. Yeah. No, I don't. I doubt. I don't think.
Thank God they didn't have a daughter.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. It could have been ugly. No, I don't think that there was an entail involved. But anyway, but my point is that does not seem to be the story here. We do not have, you know, the boring but rich Bagginses, you know, coming in to the rescue of the storied, legendary, traditionally powerful Tooks. No, it's the opposite. I mean, the Tooks are still undoubtedly richer than the Bagginses. Bungo is marrying up, like all the way across socially, you know, socially, kind of politically, financially. Bungo is marrying up. And again, so really, the question is, why did Belladonna have him? And we don't know. I mean, we're not told that story. We don't know anything about Bilbo's parents other than what we're told there and the implications of the imbalance in their finances.
It seems as though the only thing we can really conclude, in my opinion, is they must have had genuine affection for each other.
Yes. No, I mean, it does seem so. I mean, it does seem like a sort of an unlikely and slightly odd love match.
Or there's some kind of weird sort of intervention by higher power to produce the Took Baggins line that would come to save the world later.
Yes. Yes. Well, I mean, and it's definitely you know, one thing that to kind of glance forward again through the rest of the book, one of the things that we see happening is, you know, it's kind of, one might expect from the opening that what's going to happen with Bilbo is that, like, he starts off as a really boring Baggins guy, but he's got this, like, awesome adventurous Tookness kind of, you know, implicit in him. And so as the story goes on, he gets, like, less boring and more awesome until, like, at the end, he's really totally come out of his shell. And now he is, like, 100% swashbuckling Took and, you know, has left, like, the boring Bagginsishness behind. And that's not at all what happens. He does sort of get more in touch with his Took side, but he never loses his Baggins side. And in some ways his Baggins side becomes stronger as the story goes on. So we have, it's important to remember that Tolkien is not setting up at the beginning, nor does he ever come around to suggesting that the Baggins side is bad or in fact boring or anything that basically that there's really a preference.
Right.
What the ultimate drama of Bilbo's character is going to be essentially a reconciliation between those two things. You know, that he
basically resolves them.
Yeah, he can really become the best of both worlds. He can really appreciate the best of both worlds, and that he can have the goods of both sides because they really are goods. And so in this way, you can kind of see. Bungo and Belladonna coming together, you know, that, you know, one could almost suggest that they might have kind of seen that in that each of them appreciated in the other, you know, what the other one was. Though there is one other implication that we get of their relationship, which is that Belladonna Took certainly had no adventures after she became the wife of Bungo Baggins, which does suggest that he was not very approving of the whole adventurous thing, and perhaps was, I don't know if ashamed would be quite the right word, but was not really accepting of this particular of the particular Tookish aspects of his wife and her family. It does potentially invite the image of, like, awkward family gatherings when Bungo was hanging out with Belladonna's family.
With their strange Tookish relatives who have just come back from some trip that they're eager to tell everybody around the dinner table, and you've got Bungo sitting there sort of clicking his tongue like...
Right, exactly. Now, I mean, I don't think, you know, I think that if we take it to the extreme and picture Bungo Baggins as a kind of hobbitish, you know, Vernon Dursley or something, that would, like, not be appropriate. I think that that's going way too far. but yes, I mean, it does suggest that, you know, basically once Belladonna married Bungo, she was in this strictly non-adventurous world and lived a non-adventurous life. So I think it would probably be going too far to say like, the marriage of Bungo and Belladonna, the perfect meeting of equals, you know, or, you know, if like equals but opposites and, you know, they just appreciate about each other, like what is different from themselves. And that seems probably a greatly over-romanticized version of it. Some people want to take that reference between that one and the reference to his building a Bag End with her money, and want to build out of that a really horrible picture of their marriage, and I'm not sure that that's really warranted either. I don't think it's just that I don't want to think that Bilbo's parents were really miserable together, but that seems to me to be going a little bit far.
It's probably something sort of in between.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So Bilbo.
So how do you envision this stuff playing into the film?
Well, you know, it's an interesting question, though not at all one that I was planning to ask today. But
well, I mean, I mean less Bungo and Belladonna, and
yeah.
More.
Though that is what I was just thinking of. Like, will there be references to Bungo and Belladonna? We get their portraits in Bag End, you'll remember, in the film, in the Fellowship of the Ring. We could see the portraits of Bungo and Belladonna on the wall. Would there be any reference to them?
He has to make the dragon comment at least.
Okay, you'd think. Though I've been surprised before, but anyway, for Bilbo himself, then the key, the centerpiece of Bilbo's depiction, in chapter one of The Hobbit, is that he is a second edition of his, you know, of his Baggins father. You know, he is like Bungo come again. He is entirely respectable, entirely predictable, and then he ends up getting dragged off on these adventures. Now, there are a couple instances, you know, we have this internal conflict within Bilbo, in a sense. That is, we know that he is – there's the famous passage where he responds to Gandalf when he hears Gandalf's name, and we learn that he actually takes delight in things which are adventurous and not very predictable or respectable, that he loves Gandalf's fireworks. And he loves the stories that Gandalf used to tell, these adventurous stories, which is, of course, one place where hobbits could have learned about dragons. So we know that, and this is where the narrator says that, you know, you can see from Bilbo's reaction, you can see that he was not quite so prosy as he liked to believe. That there is something not just prosy but poetic, and that actually I think is one of the metaphors that I think is really illustrative that Tolkien uses about the Took and Baggins side. The Baggins side is like prose, and the Took side is like poetry. And Bilbo is thinking about these old stories, and he is excited about those things. He doesn't, you know, lose himself completely. As soon as the conversation with Gandalf comes around to the possibility of his being invited to participate in an adventure or being sent on an adventure by Gandalf, he is completely flustered and runs away. So there is no – we don't have a Bilbo who has any kind of conscious struggle. You know, at least not at the very beginning, who's sitting around thinking like, gosh, I'm really kind of bored with this life. But no, I really shouldn't. He's not like that at all. He is kind of drawn to these things, but he has no conscious struggle. He's not dissatisfied. He's not bored. He's not secretly, like, in his heart of hearts pining to go off on adventures. He finds some of these things appealing, in ways that, but notice that, you know, that sentence that I quoted, he was not so prosy as he liked to think. He likes to think of himself as prosy. But he's not, so that is his self-image is not sort of, he doesn't think of himself as one way and is like, no, I shouldn't be that way. He thinks of himself as like Bungo. He thinks of himself as just Baggins. That is his entire self-image. And that's the way that he is. It's the way that he acts. But he has these inclinations. There's something he perhaps got something queer in his makeup from the Took side, as the narrator says. Hmm. The other time, of course, when the Took side comes out, there are two other, of course, crucial moments in the unexpected party scene where this comes out. The first is when the dwarves are singing their song, and Bilbo is swept away by the song. So he is imaginatively carried into the dwarf world when they're singing their Far Over the Misty Mountains cold song. And he is his mind is drawn into this, you know, the desire of the hearts of dwarves, and he pictures this. And then what snaps him out of this sort of Tookish, this very Tookish mood, of imagining carrying a sword instead of a walking stick, and thinking about the dragon treasure and everything, is imagining any actual physical danger to himself. He sees somebody lighting a perfectly ordinary wood fire off in the distance out his window, and he imagines dragons coming to the hill and destroying everything. And then immediately the fear that inspires makes him, you know, he is immediately Mr. Baggins Underhill again. And that is, so that's, you know, that's basically his reaction. He becomes Bagginsish again after that sort of semi-conscious Tookish flirtation. The second moment, of course, the third total that I'm talking about here is when the narrator says the Took side had won. This is when he overhears Glowin in the other room saying that he looked more like a grocer than a burglar and asking, will he do? And Bilbo overhears this and gets really angry and goes back and, in his own words, puts his foot in it. And he does that because he wants to be considered fierce. Like Glowin says that he doesn't look very fierce. He looks more like a grocer than a burglar. And Bilbo is furious. And his reaction, and this is, I think, the most Tookish thing about this is the nature of his reaction. If he were 100% Baggins and he heard a dwarf in the other room say that he looks more like a grocer than a burglar, that, like, you know, will he do as a burglar? This guy looks like a crappy burglar, and I don't think he would be very fierce. You'd think a 100% Baggins would respond to that by saying, well, of course I'm not fierce. You know, of course I'm not going to make a good burglar. Honestly, like, you know, that he would be insulted if somebody said he would make a good burglar. Instead, Bilbo wants to prove himself. His response is to be like, no, I want to be considered fierce. I want to be considered like I am any good as a burglar. I'm willing to volunteer to prove myself, that he cares what the dwarves think of him, that he wants to sort of defend his non-existent reputation as an adventurer. And that's exactly the posture that he adopts when he goes back into them. And he says that he would go and fight walk to the east of east and fight the wild wereworms in the last desert. That's, again, he's, you know, striking this posture of like, see, like, what an awesome, like, would-be adventurer I am. Like, I'm totally competent and I'm completely fearless. And that posture is completely alien to the Baggins side. Again, it's just hard to imagine Bungo Baggins would have had that reaction if he had overheard Glow and said the same thing about him. You know, it really is.
It's
so,
a weird moment.
Yeah, and that's where I think that we can see – that's the way in which the Tookish side comes out in Bilbo, that where – you know, it is sort of the premise upon which he operates there. And so his sort of the drama where he begins is in that kind of conflict between the things which he explicitly values and the way in which he pictures himself, but also these things that he is drawn to, these things that he finds in a sense desirable. He loved those old stories of Gandalf's. He was amazed by Gandalf's fireworks. And he found Gandalf's magic and fireworks very, very, very compelling, very appealing. And he clearly finds the dwarves' song and story very appealing. Like, it, it awakens desires within him. And these are Tokish desires. These are not Bagginsish desires. And so those are the two things that are kind of coming together, are these Tokish ideas, these poetic Tokish desires, and his Baggins culture and values.
Right.
And priorities on being, you know, on being safe and comfortable primarily. Now, so in the films, exactly how are they going to treat Bilbo at the beginning? That was sort of a long, obviously I really like talking about this. This is what, I spent a lot of time in my book talking about the Tolkien Baggins thing. I think it's one of the most central, and to me very interesting aspects of the drama of The Hobbit and what's going on in the book.
Right.
And but
so there's hints of it already in the trailer. Yeah. You have Martin Freeman sitting there saying, "I'm a Baggins, a Bagend."
Yep.
Presumably yep. In response to some proposal that he go on an adventure.
Right. Right. Exactly. And so that, and I agree, that line I think is interesting. That is his identification with the place, with the location, and with, I suspect, therefore implicitly, the society. Right. Mm-hmm. The way that that line is phrased in the trailer does seem to imply not only his own personal identity, but his standing in society.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yes, that it's not just, that's who I think of myself, but this is how I'm perceived.
Right,
and
right.
And I have to meet the expectations and right. accept the norms of the society around me.
Right. Right, exactly. Now, but again, that leads to, I mean, the question, which I think is not certain to me, is how conflicted are they going to make Bilbo's character? Because I can see, I mean, that one line doesn't really reveal how they're going to be treating this all the way through. That is, are they going to show him as, dissatisfied? You know, like at the beginning of the Fellowship of the Ring, Frodo is dissatisfied. Yeah. You know, he is not content in the Shire. And this is because he's been, you know, quite thoroughly infected by Bilbo on this. He's in a totally different place than Bilbo was at the beginning of The Hobbit. But that's exactly the element that was missing in Bilbo. He's not, as we're told about Frodo in the Fellowship of the Ring, he's not looking at maps and wondering what lay beyond their edges. Mm-hmm. He's not wandering around looking for wayfarers from outside the Shire to talk to find out what's going on in the world at large. He is completely wrapped up in his life there in Bag End and going for walks just in the county round. You know, he's got that map in the hall of his favorite walks. But it's just the surrounding area. He's not interested in the world outside the Shire. And even the description at the beginning of chapter 2 in the book of his progress, that he has no sense of boundaries. He clearly has not looked at a map that contains more than his possibly even his little part of the Shire.
Mm-hmm.
Because he has no names for things, you know, no names are given in the book. You know, we pass from, the Lone Lands is kind of a name, but not exactly. Anyway, Bilbo does not have that curiosity. He doesn't have that drive. But I wonder, in the film, that would be one thing that they could do. Because, of course, one of the challenges with trying to translate this to a visual medium, and this is a kind of thing that we've talked about a lot, because this is one of the major questions when you're thinking about an adaptation from a book to a film, adapting to a visual medium, you can't do the internal things the same way. You know, you can't just give a viewer this kind of window into what's going on in Bilbo's internal character. You can't do that on screen the way that you can do that in a book, the way that through a narrator's descriptions you can.
Right.
So I wonder if they're going to make Bilbo be sort of explicitly
much more resistant.
Well,
maybe initially at the beginning when he's in the Shire, he's going to put up more of a fight or something. But yeah, they're going to have to find some way to portray the internal conflict externally.
Right, right, exactly. Yeah, but is his resistance in the film going to be, he doth protest too much kind of thing? Like, he really wants to go, but he's just like, no, I shouldn't.
Right.
How much are they going to make it appeal to him? Another way to ask this question, or rather perhaps I should say, I guess, a related question about the depiction of Bilbo, is how much of a doofus is he going to be at the beginning of the film? because I think he might be a pretty big doofus at the beginning of the film.
Yeah, I think so too.
Which is interesting, because of course in the book he's not a doofus exactly. I mean, he's pompous. He's sort of pompous and self-satisfied and he's not exactly a prig, but he's very stuffy. Mm-hmm. And sort of fat and comfortable. But I mean that in more than just referring to his physical size.
Yeah.
But in the film, they're clearly, it's from the trailers, it's not obvious that that's what they're going for, that they're going to have him be sort of stuffy and stuck up.
Right.
But instead, kind of bumbling and clueless. Bilbo is clueless about adventures, but he is not primarily a, like, tripping over things and, dropping stuff and the cluelessness of Bilbo at the beginning is nothing like, say, the cluelessness that they depict in Pippin in the films.
Yes.
You know, like tripping over things and knocking armor down wells and, you know, you can do that kind of stuff endearingly, to use the word that we were using before, are they going to make Bilbo a buffoon?
Yes. I don't think there's any indication in the trailers, at least so far, in what we've seen. I don't think they're going that direction.
Yeah, I don't know. It would be interesting because, of course, it would be defensible, I think, in one way, because if one of the things that we're getting here is sort of the more objective version, Bilbo's the Hobbit story is told from Bilbo's perspective. The book that we have, of course, is not Bilbo's private diary, but a redaction based on Bilbo's private diary. Mm-hmm. But we still have things like, you know, it's still fundamentally from Bilbo's point of view. This is what he called being on his dignity, right? But I'm sure it didn't look like that to the dwarves. From a more objective standpoint, or even from the dwarves' standpoint, or from Gandalf's standpoint, he clearly looked different, as Gandalf makes clear in the quest for Erebor when he describes, how absurdly Bilbo acted, mm-hmm, during the unexpected party. So you could imagine he probably does look like a complete git to the dwarves and to Thorin. And so having actually depicting his character as being more of a git, I think would be defensible in that way. And certainly they would find, if they're coming and expecting a professional burglar, you know, a professional treasure hunter, and they find Bilbo instead, he's certainly going to look like a buffoon to them.
Yes.
I could see it. I mean, I think it's defensible. But it really involves how much do you want the audience to be laughing at Bilbo at the beginning. You can do that. I mean, you know, you don't necessarily lose that much because you can show the progress of his character. I don't know. It's certainly not the way they handled the character arc of Frodo in the Lord of the Rings, of course. He was never, you know, he was clueless, but he was not, he was never a buffoon.
Right.
Though, of course, there they had other hobbits to deflect that onto. Now here they have dwarves to deflect that onto, right? I mean, we have, yes, Bomber to the rescue. So that's and the other dwarves apparently too. I mean, there's going to be a fair bit of buffoonery among them.
I gotta be honest with you. I don't expect Bilbo to be that much of a buffoon. I think he's actually – I think they're going to be very measured with that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I can definitely see that. I mean, I think that would definitely work. Mm-hmm. But yeah, how do they depict the conflict, and how do they depict this struggle? I mean, say how do they depict the conflict implies that they're going to depict the same conflict or a similar conflict in Bilbo's character as was in the book. But that's not really even clear to me. One of the things that I think is hard, is the values that Tolkien associates with the Baggins side are some which I think are actually a little bit challenging to depict sympathetically in a film. And they actually they did an okay job of this, I thought, in the Lord of the Rings films. The way that they treat the Shire and the sort of the fun and safety and comfort of the Shire in the interactions we see among the hobbits at the beginning. Though even there, like, you know, the hobbit picking his nose and, you know, like, we do get the hobbits themselves more broadly as buffoons, in the Fellowship of the Ring film. They're very bumpkinish. You know, they're kind of charming and it looks like fun, but they're very unsophisticated, in some negative ways as well as in some kind of positive ways. And so if the stuff which in the book is associated with a Baggins life is simply associated in the minds of viewers with being provincial, with being close-minded, even with being, sort of lazy and oblivious, it's going to be hard to depict that as a positive. How are they going to treat that aspect of Bilbo's character as not a negative? You know, how do you keep the Took versus Baggins side in Bilbo's character in the film from being simply a, you know, good versus bad impulse? Like, okay, maybe he still likes the Shire and is happy to be home, but what is that other thing in his character which is not – because the heroism, the adventurous side is the side which is obviously suitable to, like, how do you make him continue to not fit in a positive way? Because that's what happens in the book. He never fits in with the dwarves. He's never the same as them. Even as he gets acclimated and becomes their leader, he never fits in with them. And that's still clearly a good thing with him. So yeah, I don't know. I mean, and especially there at the beginning, I think it's going to be crucial how they depict Bilbo at the start for that reason. The better they set that up at the beginning, the more they're going to be able to work with later on. But if it's just like, oh, I'm a stay-at-home hobbit and I don't want to leave and I don't like adventures and I don't want to know anything and I don't want to be involved in anything besides, I just want to stay home and smoke my pipe.
I think we've gotten hints of this in the trailer and in some of the production videos that I think what they do is they invest 5 or 10 minutes in showing his idyllic Shire life. They show him sitting comfortably in the evening, smoking his pipe and eating delicious meals. They show him wandering around the market, interacting with other hobbits, that he socially fits in. They just basically show him having an idyllic life, and then they show the dwarves showing up and Gandalf showing up as being kind of sort of infringing on that or impinging on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's. I'll be interested to see what kind of values are attached to the Baggins. Again, if they even maintain anything like this kind of split between his Took side and his Baggins side, mm-hmm. If they do that in the depiction of his character, what kinds of values they associate with the Baggins side?
Yeah.
As opposed to the Took side, and basically in the same thing with how they treat the Took side. Because the distinction between poetic and prosy you talk about hard things to depict on film. Like that's a pretty tricky distinction to get at. But I think it's one of the most evocative. It's in itself still a complicated metaphor in many ways, I think, to understand even in the book. But thinking about aspects like that, I can't imagine them really doing. So what are they going to do exactly? And I think I will be very interested to see, you know, I've a very long list of things that I'm going to be looking for and paying particular attention to when I see the film. One of the things that I am very curious to see on this subject is how they handle Bilbo during the dwarf song. Mm-hmm. You know, we know thanks to the trailer that the dwarf song is going to be sung. And, you know, I really like the song. I really like the melody, you know, like hats off to Howard Shore there. I think that's going to be awesome. I've heard several sung versions of that song, of course, you know, in various audiobook productions and of course the Rankin-Bass film and all that stuff. But this version, the song, you know, as sung by Richard Armitage is the best one that I've heard. I certainly like it best than the rest of them. So they're doing the song. How are they going to do Bilbo during and after the song? Are they going to try to capture some aspect? Again, it would be so much harder to do on film, but are they going to try to capture some aspect of Bilbo being transported by this song? Of this song being one of the moments which is really influential in not only sort of bringing him to the place where he's going to agree to go along with them, but also just sort of revealing to us the internal struggle within Bilbo's character. I'd be very interested to see how they do that.
Yep. Me too. So perhaps we should get on to our prediction of the week. Start talking a little bit about kind of how they're going to delve into the Baggins versus Took dichotomy and imagery via Bilbo's interaction with other Hobbit characters on screen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. How are they going to be? And in a sense, I guess one way to think about this was like Bilbo's cultural position almost. And our four options are: option A is the film is going to depict Bilbo as culturally mainstream. You know, he is going to be like
thoroughly Baggins.
Yes, he is going to be like, you know, the Hobbit's Hobbit. You know, the guy who is clearly accepted by the whole society. You know, and this is basically what seems to be implied in the book, that he is accepted by all of his neighbors, that he has good relationships with all of his neighbors, that he is like the heart of Hobbiton and everybody loves Bilbo and everybody has, you know, basically good relationships with Bilbo,
right.
That he is at the, you know, at the hub of Hobbit culture in the Shire.
Yes. And if people, if there are any sort of less than approving things that people say about him, it's more just kind of maybe wondering at his normality given his Took parentage.
Right, right, exactly. Or maybe, you know, and you know,
I can't believe he turned out so well. Some butter right. Like that.
Right, right. And it doesn't have to be like everybody has to love him necessarily. I mean, like we could still get the Sackville Bagginses and have them be envious of him because he's rich and because he has Bag End and all that stuff. So I mean, you know, but that's all perfectly normal.
That's like normal Hobbit envy.
Right. The key is exactly the key that's all within the Hobbit culture. The key is that for option A is that he is first of all fully acclimated within the culture and second of all not viewed by that culture as an outsider in any way. You know, that there's nothing strange or deviant about him culturally.
Right.
Option B is that basically he's going to be seen as more isolated. That is, that he's not really connected with the Hobbit culture. And this is actually in some ways and it's implied that he's connected to the culture. But again, in the book, we never actually see him interacting. He is Hobbit culture for us at the beginning. And so basically option B is they're going to actually downplay. They're not going to show very, you know, they might show him like, you know, shaking hands with people in the marketplace or whatever, but he's not going to be like at the heart of Hobbit culture. He's yes. going to be, he's going to be isolated. He's going to yes. be on it. He's going to be primarily a loner.
So the other Hobbits don't view him with suspicion or disapproval. They just don't really think much about him. Because they don't know him, because he's sort of disconnected from the rest of his
right, disconnected society. From society, right? Not seen as adventurous, not seen as, you know, not distrusted for tookish reasons, but just that he's sort of disconnected from the society, yeah. And that's a way that I could imagine the films doing this as a way to set up
This what they'd eventually be doing, or basically be doing, is trying to hint at some kind of proclivity for something different. This would be the guy who's sort of, you know, like, you know, living the normal life, doing all the right things, going through the motions, but at core feels some sort of desire for something more.
Right, though it's not clear what, and he doesn't have any kind of a reputation. Option C is that basically that they are going to play up his took side, that they're going to make him already kind of deviant in yeah. tookish ways.
Well,
that he's
already on the path toward becoming who he, the way he ultimately is viewed.
Right. That he's got a reputation as something of an not necessarily an adventurer, but and so therefore, basically, I could see this the statement that Bilbo makes to Gandalf in the trailer. Mm-hmm. I could see that in this context as basically him trying to insist, like, no, I can't do this. Like, I have a reputation that I'm supposed to maintain, even though, like, he hasn't always maintained it. You know, you could see that as a kind of like a guilt move almost. Like, you know, I'm supposed to be, I'm supposed to be this, even if I haven't been it perfectly yet, or, you know, to this point that like, I don't want to go any further in that direction. Because basically this option C would think from the filmmaker's standpoint be the simplest.
Yes.
That is, you could, because again, trying to set this up on film, you can only do so much completely internal struggle on screen.
Right. So
if you want to indicate that there is this conflict, you know, this conflict within him, that he has this, the film version of the narrator statement in the book that he must have gotten something queer in his makeup from the took side, would have to be shown. By this, you know, that like there is some external reason to associate him with, you know, tookishness and adventurousness.
Right.
So, yeah.
And I think that, you know, and you're getting at a good point, which is try as they might to maybe portray A, because it's so difficult to do this on screen.
Yeah.
There's nothing stopping the audience from bringing their own expectations and preconceived notions about this character, especially if they haven't read the book. There's nothing stopping people from just assuming that he's the weirdo Bilbo Baggins adventurous guy.
Right.
Especially
if they're coming from the Lord of the Rings films only.
Yes.
Their thought of Bilbo in Hobbit society is going to be like him telling the Hobbit children the story of the trolls at the party, right?
Yep.
Now, obviously, he's telling a story about something that happened to him in the Hobbit, so he's not going to be doing exactly that. But this idea is, I mean, you know, so basically
showing him wandering the market, interacting with people, being friendly, all that kind of stuff. None of that is incompatible with the Bilbo portrayed in the films.
No, I don't think so at all.
Yeah.
Because you could still get, you know, one way that this could be handled and could be done again fairly efficiently from a film standpoint could be, you know, like a conversation behind his back, even in the marketplace. You know, he walks by in the marketplace and somebody's like, there goes that Bilbo, you know, and to give some indication that everybody sees him as like a little bit different.
Right.
You know, there's something strange about him, so that the viewer is then like, oh, there's something strange about Bilbo. I wonder what it is. And then we're going to see him develop into an adventurer.
Yeah, it's much easier to do that than to have him walk by and have people say, that Bilbo guy is such an upstanding guy. Because again,
right.
That's not incompatible with the Bilbo from the Fellowship of the Ring.
Right.
You know, like, we don't actually get a real strong sort of sense of widespread disapproval or concern about Bilbo in the films. It doesn't come across well.
We
get the one scene of the scowling guy, but that's at Gandalf.
Yep. Right. Exactly.
Not a Bilbo.
Yep. But see, we could get exactly the way – that's a perfect example of the way that this kind of thing could be efficiently depicted. Weird glance or two at his back as he goes by in the marketplace.
That's my point. Like, as you said, C is much easier to do. A is kind of try as they might to convince us that he's actually mainstream Baggins guy. If the audience just assumes that that he's a Tookish guy, that he's Bilbo from The Lord of the Rings – you know, no matter what they do, they may not get that message across. It's much harder to do.
Right. But now, see, option B is basically kind of like the middle ground.
Yes.
Because, of course, the danger of doing C is that you actually greatly reduce
the
drama.
Yep.
Yeah, of his character. Yep. And, of course, as we know, the Lord of the Rings films were all about introducing character arc and drama.
That's
internal
right.
drama. Like, we've got to make Aragorn really conflicted, or else it won't be good. And we've got to make Faramir really conflicted, right? I mean, the way that they introduced internal character conflicts where there were none
was to externalize it as choices and actions.
Exactly. And so you've got to, I mean, I've got to think they're not going to downplay this aspect of Bilbo's character, because it's exactly the kind of thing they were hauling in and inventing for other characters, in The Lord of the Rings. So I got to think they're going to do this. And if they do that, if they're too over the top with an option C approach, then they really minimize the development. If he's just like an adventurer waiting to happen at any minute, then when the dwarves show up, then like, hey, all right, awesome. Like,
alas,
this
I've been
is
waiting
my destiny.
For you.
Yes, exactly. Then basically you lose that drama. So I can't think they're going to do that. Again, I don't think that is in the end an argument, like a total argument against C, but they have to be careful in how they do that. And so B would basically be a way that you can create the fact that there's create some separation between mm-hmm. him and Hobbit society. Like, he's not exactly mainstream. But also he's not just an adventurer waiting to happen. He's not just like basically the reaction when he goes away with dwarves, it's not that everybody's going to be like, oh, well, of course he did. Like, it was only a matter of time before that Bilbo did something like that. Whereas, you know, his going off on the adventure, if they go option C, would not be seen as totally – as inconsistent with his character. Surprising still maybe that he actually went up and did it. But basically,
yeah, it really reduces the character.
You would have people saying or being able to say, see, like, I always knew that one of these days Bilbo was going to go off the, you know, do something weird.
Yeah.
That would be like but again,
the way they did it about Frodo.
Right. Exactly. But in option B, there would still be this. Now, option D is essentially
they won't afford the screen time to deal much with this.
Exactly. They're just gonna strip it down.
Even if they have scenes him in the Shire, they just those scenes will be
Like a 15-second pastiche.
Yeah, kind of mood. They'll be there to show us how beautiful New Zealand is.
Yes, exactly.
Not aimed to really delve into these issues. So here's my question for you. Which of these would you consider to be the Mark Fisher, true to the book answer.
we really should stop teasing Mark about this. But yes, I would say the purest answer would be A, mainstream. Mm-hmm. You could make an argument for B because, again, it's like functionally in B, functionally the book's depiction is B because we never see him interacting. We don't see other hobbits. But the general sense is that he is heartily approved, that basically, if in chapter one of the book you were to turn to one of Book Bilbo's neighbors in Hobbiton and say, like, what do you think of that Bilbo Baggins? They would be like, oh, I think he's great. I think he is like, you know, what every hobbit hopes to be when he grows up. And that's the option A answer. If the person in Hobbiton would say, like, well, I don't know, he kind of keeps to himself, but I have no objections, you know, that would be option B. If, you know, so basically, like, he's a little different. He's perhaps a little bit different, but I don't have any active suspicions about him or associate anything in particular with him.
He keeps to himself. We don't really talk to him much.
Right. Exactly. Then option C would be like, yeah, oh, that Bilbo, like, he's trouble, and one fine day he's gonna, like, go off on a mad adventure. That would be obviously option C. So I think, you know, when you think about it from that way, like, clearly Bilbo's neighbors in the book would say option A. You know, yes. they would say, like, oh yeah, like, Bilbo Baggins, he's the Hobbit's Hobbit. Like, he's totally mainstream.
That's right.
Because he is, in the book, he is Hobbit culture. You know, I mean, he is showing us Hobbit culture, really kind of both aspects of Hobbit culture, because the way in which the Tolkien Baggins is split within him at the beginning does also seem to be a reflection of how it's split in Hobbit culture, that the primary, just as Bilbo is always like 90% Baggins or 95% Baggins with these kind of, you know, Tookish, like, mostly submerged holdovers in his character, that seems to be what Hobbit society is like, with almost all of them being like Bilbo and being of the Bagginsish variety. But this one family, which is rich and prominent and important and powerful, but outnumbered vastly by the Bagginses. So I think that A is clearly A is definitely the book answer here.
A is the book answer. All right. Well, we know which one Mark will pick.
You're just relentless.
Yep. Yep. Although I can't remember. So for our previous question, which one was the book answer? I don't even remember. But just for what it's worth, on our previous question, question number 9, which was what was it again? Oh man.
That wasn't the Ringwraith one, was it?
No, it was
Oh, it was the frame. It was the opening.
Yes, the frame narrative. Correct. Every single person has picked D.
Every single person, which was the ominous ending, right?
Yes. Yeah. We're missing
that was the beginning. That was the I'm thinking of the ending question.
Right, and what everyone has picked is frame story moment, right, involving Bilbo and Frodo.
Frame story moment, right,
yeah,
right.
Nobody bought our other answers. There's still a few people who have yet to answer: Father Roderick, Hannah, Lily, the Last Alliance people. But everyone who has answered so far has picked T.
Yeah. Well, no, that's interesting.
There wasn't a true the book answer for that one. So
yeah, exactly. Well, actually, I mean, again, like the totally true to the book answer would be, I guess, like Bilbo sitting and smoking on his front step and Gandalf approaching him. But
and in fairness to Mark Fisher, he hasn't answered a completely true to the book.
No, you've totally stereotyped him. You've totally pigeonholed him.
He hasn't done that in over a month. Although, actually, I don't think the last 4 questions have had true to the book answers, because there've been things like, "What will the main role of the Nazgul be in the Hobbit film?"
It really is kind of hard. Well, no, the true to the book answer is like, they're nowhere, man. They're off in Mordor.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's a good point.
Minding their own business.
He didn't pick that, although he did say he was very tempted by it.
Yes. Well, God, I'm always tempted by the straight up book answer. Yes. So, which leads me to get to my actual prediction here. I am not going to go with the book answer. I don't think they're going to do it, because I think it's going to lead to complications. I expect some version of C.
You think they're going to make him Tookish?
I do. I think they're going to make him.
They're going to sacrifice the character development?
No, I think they're going to still try to do the character development. I think they're going to make him a conflicted C.
And after your very fascinating discussion about how B is like the I just assumed you would pick B because you spent like 8 minutes talking about how B is the perfect compromise between A and C.
I think it is. I think it is, but I don't think they're going
to. You
do
don't
it.
Think they'll do that?
I don't. I don't. When it comes to actual prediction of what I think will really occur, I think it's going to be C. I certainly do not think that they're going to like willfully sacrifice character arc and development. But I think that what they're going to do is make him explicitly conflicted. Like, I think they're going to depict him as a hobbit with clear Tookish tendencies, which everybody else can see, but with him like consciously fighting against it.
Okay. We need to establish some kind of clear metric for measuring Tookishness. How are we going to decide?
Well,
how are we going to decide which of these
the thing
is right?
How we're going to – it's all about what his neighbors in Hobbiton would say. This is about his perception by this – his relationship to the society, not just a question of his internal Tookishness.
Right.
So I think he's going to be conflicted about it, but I think that if you – I think that at the end of the day, if you interview one of his Hobbiton film neighbors, they would say, oh yeah, like that Bilbo, he's weird.
And suppose what we get on screen in the theaters in December, December 14th, when this comes out in the US, after it premieres in Northern and Eastern Europe.
They're doing it in Europe first?
Yeah, let me pull up the IMDb thing. Let's see if I got it.
I hear that.
Dang it, I didn't remember it.
I'm paying attention.
Oh man, you gotta get with it, dude.
Ah, absolutely.
They're rolling it over. It's gonna take them 20 days to do the worldwide release.
Oh.
It's starting in Belgium, Denmark, France, Norway, Sweden on the 12th. Germany, Greece, Hong Kong, Hungary, Israel, Netherlands, Russia, Singapore, 13th. Canada, Italy, Japan, New Zealand, Paraguay, Romania, South Africa, Spain, UK, and US, the 14th.
Wait. New Zealand?
New Zealand is the 14th.
What?
I know.
It's not going to world premiere in Wellington? Seriously?
Yeah,
no.
Well, I imagine they'll do the like some kind of screening or something,
screening.
Yeah, isn't that weird though? I mean, I guess is it possible maybe that with the time zone stuff that it'll actually be premiering at exactly the same time in New Zealand? But yeah, isn't that weird?
No, because the 14th in New Zealand, I mean, they're a day ahead of us in New Zealand. I mean, it's June 1st already in New Zealand right now.
Yes.
So
there's no way they can catch up to Belgium and France.
No.
Yeah, it's so weird.
Good golly. Well, see, I mean, this is like the kind of thing where like, you know, it's easy to sit around and be like, what are they thinking? And then of course there are like the rules and like the with the studios and the like, there's so much behind this that we have no idea of.
Sure,
like, who knows the politics of,
I'm sure
of this?
Some part of it is related to minimizing piracy and all kinds of weird stuff. Yeah,
yeah, no,
but it is weird. The poor people in Argentina have to wait until the 1st of January.
What? Oh man.
Yeah, I know.
That's really odd.
Yeah, it's odd. So. Anyway, on the 14th, when this thing
on the 14th in
the theater,
America and Canada.
So here's my thinking, or my question for you: suppose all we get is images, is even extensive scenes, but all we get is Bilbo wandering around, interacting with people at the market, saying hello, being friendly, all that kind of stuff. We don't get any office style side interviews with his neighbors. We don't get any strange stares or sidelong glances or muttered comments or anything like that. All we get are just scenes of him going about his daily life in the Shire. Is that Are we to interpret that as and furthermore, we don't get him making comments about his role or his place in society. We don't have him saying, you know, hey, these people already think I'm a weirdo. I'm not going on a trip.
Right.
Or him saying, hey, I've got to think about my position. You know, I'm going to run for mayor someday and I can't be, you know, they'll use these in the campaign ads against me. Suppose all we get is just him going about his daily life, and then we get some internal conflict stuff that hints at his internal conflict, but not how he's interacting with society. Is that D?
Well, it's D. Okay. Yeah, it's D. I mean, in order for A, B, or C to be demonstrably true,
we need
to get data about how other hobbits
view
it.
Actual data. Data beyond just Bilbo buying a loaf of bread.
Right, exactly.
All right.
Because that doesn't prove what people actually think of him.
Yes.
Though I would say, if we get pictures not – like if the montage goes on long enough, that is if we get like Bilbo in the marketplace, Bilbo in the pub, you know, Bilbo playing quoits in the yard with his buddies, then it's clearly not B. Right, I mean, he's clearly not a loner. If we see him in diverse social settings, mm-hmm. then I think that we can clearly say that B is not the answer.
Right.
But that would definitely, even if we see nothing else, that would certainly lean towards A. I mean, I would think if we get like a long montage of like him, like in Happy Hobbit society, I would conclude that that was A.
Yep.
Basically, we would need some kind of definite thing. We would need some, you know, scowl behind his back, some whisper of one person to another, some kind of dark look or overheard conversation in order to prove C.
Yes. All right. Well, I'm going with D then.
Okay. Well, that's like the if mine is based on film efficiency, yours is based on even more film efficiency.
Mine's going with. I don't think we'll get or. So when I say D, I don't mean they'll just cut all those scenes.
Right.
I mean we'll get scenes, but not sufficient data. I think it's just going to be images of him wandering around the markets, but I don't think we're going to actually have. I don't think the filmmakers are going to go out of their way to say, look, we've got to make sure that the audience understands that he's a Baggins and that everyone sees him as a Baggins. So we need to have characters explicitly saying, boy, that Bilbo sure is a very normal hobbit who wouldn't go on any adventures.
Right.
I don't see them doing that.
Well,
that's too on the nose.
I do, because they did that in the Lord of the Rings films.
Well, okay, I could see them doing – if they're going to do it – so here's my take. If
okay.
Peter Jackson feels – if his intention is to communicate that he's a weirdo, I think he would do that.
Uh-huh.
If his intention is to tell a story where he's a Baggins and he's normal, I think he'll just – find other ways to communicate it beyond other characters' reactions to Bilbo. I think they'll just have Bilbo insisting to Gandalf that he's a Baggins and he doesn't go on any of them far-flung adventures.
Right.
So.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. I can certainly imagine scenarios in which A might be accurate but hard to prove.
Yep. Basically, that's what I'm coming down on is I actually have faith that that's the story they want to tell. I just think that it won't be – I think they'll decide that the screen time is not worth dedicating toward trying to prove it.
Right.
So I'm going with D, man.
Going with D? All right.
Yes.
Well, I think we're going to get scowls and whispers and odd looks. I definitely
– I really can bring back that same guy.
Yeah, he was a great scowler.
He was an accomplished scowler.
That was a fantastic scowl that guy has. So yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
and
good.
We'll,
all right.
We'll find out the answer on December 14th. That's when it's coming out
in America.
So now we have a date.
Those of our listeners who live in Europe will be able to tell us in advance.
Yeah, now we'll have a date to fixate on. By the way, I don't know if you know, but or if your listeners know, but there's an opportunity to win a Hobbit production shirt from The One Ring.
Oh yes, yes, I had heard about that.
Yeah, they're doing it through it. Basically, the guy playing Bolg, who also happens to be Gregor Clegane in Game of Thrones. He's giving away his shirt. So it won't fit anyone. But
that's what I was just going to say. What on earth uses that? Yeah, so if you need a tent, you can enter to win. Yes.
Yep.
Yeah, that's very good.
And also, I don't know if you saw the press release about the impending horror being released this fall, the Guardians of Middle-Earth video game.
Oh, yes.
We're going to see one-on-one grudge matches between Gollum and Sauron duking it out.
Won't that be fun?
Yeah.
Won't that be fun? Yeah.
They're really staying true to the spirit of the books.
No, there's nothing truer to the spirit of the books than that. I actually think it would be... it would be really funny to make a parody of this game that was true to the books. That really is sort of inviting. That's Sauron versus Gollum. Yeah. Yeah. that fight would.
Or Bilbo versus Gandalf.
Yeah. Right. Very true to the spirit of the book.
The people in the chat room are hoping that we'll get office-style interviews on the extras.
Yes. Yes.
Bilbo's neighbors telling him, boy, you know, I always knew there was something strange about that guy.
Yeah. Though, you know, this is your ace in the hole here might be the whole cinematic release versus extended edition thing.
In the theaters, on screen.
Right, exactly. Because I could totally see this one being D, but then shifting around and getting some more footage to prove one of the others in the extended edition.
Cut it. Cut, Peter Jackson. Cut.
No way, man. Scowl does not take very much screen time, telling you.
5 minutes of Bilbo wandering around, getting sidelong glances, or 5 extra minutes of Avengers-style combat in the Forest of Mirkwood out on at the gates of Dol Guldur.
Well, Scowl only takes 5 seconds, so I'm still going with seeing.
Okay. All right.
All right.
Believe it or not, we've gone on for over 2 hours.
Yes, we have. Since, of course, my semester is over and I'm no longer dashing across campus to class at 11:30.
There's now no incentive to ever stop.
Exactly. Exactly. So, yes, we may get some slightly protracted Riddles in the Dark episodes here over the next few months. Well, thanks, everybody, for joining us. This has been a lot of fun. We will look forward to remember next week. We're going to be moving on to Gollum. Not necessarily talking in full about the riddle contest yet, but looking in particular about the way that they're going to handle Gollum, his characterization, his background story. Of course, there's a great deal to be thinking about, thinking about what they've already done with Gollum in the Lord of the Rings films, which they have to work with, as well as the stuff from Tolkien's own writings, because, of course, we have also the additional complexity of the alterations in Tolkien's treatment of Gollum from the first to the second edition of The Hobbit. So we've got all that stuff to kind of review and think about and go over in order to inform our thoughts about this for next week. So Gollum all the time. So get ready with your Gollum questions and comments, and we will get at that in 2 weeks.
Yep.
All right.
And I'd like to thank everybody who joined us in the chat room.
Yes.
Everyone who commented extensively on episode 9 on the Mythgard page, just to remind people, that is the preferred place for you to go and share with us your feedback. It's, of course, accepted on the Tolkien Professor and Mythgard Facebook pages, but we really want to direct as much conversation as possible to the actual Riddles in the Dark posts And on the Mythgard page, and also Twitter is also acceptable for some kind of pithy comments or questions or complaining that my audio is too quiet or things like that. The Twitter accounts, of course, are Tolkien Prof and Dave Kale. There's the Tolkien Professor and Mythgard Institute Facebook pages. And then there's the Riddles in the Dark as part of the exclusive section on Mythgard.org. So keep the conversation going there.
Excellent. Very good. Well, thanks for listening, everybody, and Godspeed.